you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour, and thank you for tuning in to the Twilight Histories on our 10th anniversary. Today, you will hear Part 6 of Blue Dragons. We're going to get started in just a moment, and before we do, I'd like to recommend a podcast to you. Historical Blindness is a podcast I really like, and I have a great deal of respect for the research and the quality put out by the host, Nathaniel Lloyd. The show examines some of the most fascinating and outrageous events in history. The idea is to examine just how reliable they are. Can we trust our own history? Nathaniel looks at stories of the Illuminati, Nazi mythos, archaeological hoaxes, the Holy Grail, Columbus, and many others. Have a listen to this short promo for Historical Blindness.
Mysteries, hoaxes, conspiracy, topics sometimes avoided by historians who don't want to draw attention to the blind spots in our knowledge of the past. But stories like these, fraught with ambiguities, teach us to view the past and the present with a critical eye. Join me, Nathaniel Lloyd, as I delve into these stories on my podcast, Historical Blindness, and shine a light in the darker corners of the past. New episodes every other Tuesday, available on Apple Podcasts and most podcast apps.
A quick note before we get started. I've tried to keep the Twilight Histories gender neutral, not to be politically correct, but for the obvious reason that it's not just dudes that listen to this show, and perhaps for the less obvious reason that I have three girls, and they may check these shows out one day. However, I broke the rule today and made this episode male-centric. The reason will become pretty obvious once you start listening. This episode, and this mini-series, is meant to wrap up some loose ends that have been dangling for almost a decade. And once these loose ends are wrapped up, I'll really be able to focus on that new direction, that kind of genderless direction in which I can put my girls in the place of the listener. I want anyone to be able to listen to these shows and be able to put themselves into the you character. And I've asked the other podcasters to be conscious of this and do that as well. And they're all on board and understand. But I have to say, I really enjoyed making this episode, and I hope that you enjoy it too. In fact, I feel that this particular series is perhaps the high watermark of everything I've done up to this point. And that's at least how I feel. But of course, you are the ultimate judge. So get comfortable, turn off the lights, and let the theater of your imagination take you away. Oh, sorry, the window just opened. It's freaking freezing. Snow? Huh? It's up to the second story. All the cars are gone. They're completely covered. My neighbor's roof is covered. Where did all this snow come from? There was grass here just an hour ago. Losing my mind? It's night. The wind is howling. The snow is whipping at your exposed face. You pull your hood down and bend into the wind. Your fur coat is familiar, though you can't remember how. You'll save that thought for later. For now, you have to focus on getting out of this storm. There are dark forms ahead. There are no other landmarks you can see in the blizzard. You move towards them. Maybe you'll find shelter there. They look like huge boulders. It's hard to tell in the dark. There's a deep, trumpeting sound. You stop. You hear it again. Yes. Definitely sounds like an elephant. An elephant? In a winter storm? The forms move. So they're not rocks. The trumpeting is coming from them. Where are you? Why can't you remember? The Twilight Histories. You're experiencing world-splitting amnesia. That must be it. Your mind is so cloudy. Yes, it's just like that feeling. You haven't experienced it this bad in a long time. The vertigo. The confusion. It will all clear up soon, you know that. It always does. In a few hours, your memories will be sharp again. You'll remember. If you survive. The trumpeting is louder. The elephants are coming towards you. Elephants? No, mammoths. They must be mammoths. Remember this world. It's coming back now. You're back. Nina, is she here? You look around. Nothing but the storm and the night and the mammoths. If she's in this world, you'll find her. But first, you must find shelter. The mammoths. Maybe. Yes, you have a feeling, like some piece of knowledge seeping through the cracks of your mind. Yes, walk to the herd. They accept you. You knew somehow they were domesticated. You press yourself against them and feel their warmth. There's a small one. It comes up to you and sniffs you with its trunk. You rub its tufted head. Nina, the baby. You rack your brain. Did she have the baby before you left? No, no. She was still pregnant. A sudden feeling of dread overcomes you. What if she died in childbirth? You came back here for a reason. Why? Why did you come back? Or did you ever leave? Maybe the other worlds are all hallucinations. Maybe the Twilight Histories, your childhood back in Hong Kong. Everything is an hallucination. Everything except for this. This world. This world with Nina and the baby. This is a bad amnesia. It's the worst you've ever had. Maybe it's because you're cold and scared. Sometimes fear can make it worse. But wow, this one is bad. Your thoughts are so fractured. You almost feel like you've lost yourself. Like your mind broke into 1,000 pieces, and you're desperately trying to pick them up and hold them together before they slip through your fingers. Focus on solid things. The mammoth fur. That is real. Hold it. Empty your mind and focus on its realness. Reality is attracted to reality. If you just keep your mind clear and focused on real things, it will all come together. Time. A great gust of wind smashes your legs, unprotected by the great bodies of the mammoths. You hope they know where they're going. It's going to be a long night. The sky above is turning blue. The storm has passed. You must have fallen asleep within that protective ring of animals. The little mammoth trumpets at you and stomps its feet in play. "Whoa there, little guy," you say, while standing to avoid its feet. It spins around, almost like a dog, then headbutts you in the chest. "Hey, down! What's your name, little guy? Do you have a name?" You tuft its head and give it a hug. Trumpets and tosses snow into the air. You press your way through the mammoths. The sun is rising over an ice world, dazzling with glittering ice diamonds. There's what looks like a small Neolithic village below in the valley. You recognize this place. Yes, this is definitely the right place. The skin huts with their mammoth tusk roofs, curling smoke rising from cooking fires. Yes, it's exactly as you remember it. Your heart thumps in your chest. Nina. Is Nina down there? You enter the village. There are people milling about, children playing. You approach an old lady drying skins. Nina, you say to her. You feel your voice awkwardly adjusting to the Neolithic sounds you once knew so well. Do you know if Nina, daughter of Braun, is here? The woman looks stunned. She's about to say something, but her words catch.
"You're alive," she says.
She knows you?
"You're alive," she says again, and places your cheeks in her hands. "Your cheeks are so cold. Your clothes are covered in ice. Are you sick?"
A sickening thought hits you. Is this Nina? An old Nina? Did you come here too late? You look into her eyes, trying to find recognition.
I was out last night. I was lost. I followed the herd.
She puts her hand on your forehead, then on your cheeks again.
"You poor dear. We have to get you home," she says.
"Home?" She makes a ticking sound as though your response confirms some suspicion she had. The woman brings you to a skin tent. She opens the flap. Nina leaps up and throws her arms around you.
"Where were you? I was so worried about you. The storm. Oh, thank goodness. Thank goodness."
"Give him some hot broth and put him to bed," the old lady says. "He needs rest."
"Oh, thank you, Mata," Nina says.
The woman leaves. You look at Nina. You feel your eyes well with tears. This is your first love, your only love. And she doesn't look a day older than you remember her. She's exactly the same. The same doe eyes, the same broad smile and full lips. You never thought you'd see her again. You had made a choice to leave her, and the pain of that choice has never left you, not after all these years. And here she is. Seeing her is like a bolt of lightning in your heart. You hug her. Her belly is full and hard, just like you remember it.
"Where were you? Are you okay?"
"Yes, I'm okay. I've never been better," you say, and you kiss her. She pushes you back.
"I'm glad you're back, but you scared me. You're covered in ice. Take off that hat, and let's get you in bed."
You feel a hot flush come over you as Nina pulls off your clothes.
"You're shaking," she says. "You must be cold."
She rubs your arms and puts a blanket around you, pressing herself into you. You feel her warmth against your body.
"Can I play outside?"
comes a small voice. You turn to see a boy, about 3 years old.
"Of course, Bron. Go outside," Nina says.
The boy runs out of the tent.
"Bron? Is that... who is that?"
Nina's eyes grow wide in shock.
"I'm sorry, I'm just confused. Maybe I'm tired. I'm not thinking straight."
"You don't remember our son?
I'm really worried. You need sleep." "I'm sorry if I'm scaring you. When was the last time we saw each other?"
4 days ago. You went out hunting. The others returned from the storm, but you didn't come back.
We were all so worried about you. What happened?"
"I don't remember. The last thing I remember, I was in the storm and I saw the mammoths. They saved my life."
"Good. That's very good.
Nina, this may sound strange, but have I been here before? I mean, with you, in this place, all this time?" She shakes her head.
"Rest," she says.
You lie your head on the pillow, and she pulls the thick fur blankets over you. Even though you don't remember why you're here, you're happy. You're happy to be here with Nina and your son, Bron. You're just, and you'll never leave here again. You're so tired. Your eyes lower from Nina to the small cooking fire, and then to the darkness of sleep.
Thank you.
You spend the next few months getting to know your place in the clan. Your amnesia never goes away. You have impressions of your past, yet you can't remember a single name, even outside this world. It's as though there were some kind of invisible barrier preventing you from accessing your past, except for the faintest traces, flashes of memory that morph and dilute, as though they were painted impressions on the wall of a cave animated by shamanistic medicine. Summer turns to fall. The clan is afraid of the advancing ice and has decided to move further south to where it's warmer. Along the route, your second son is born as the last leaves shake from their tired trees. Nina names him Daedalus.
Daedalus, you say. Where did you get that name from?
It came to me in a dream. Do you not like it?
It's not that. It's not even a name in this language.
I know. It's a strange name, she says. She's exhausted after her labor, and the little baby boy is sleeping on her chest.
I dreamed of it. The dream kept coming to me ever since your hunting trip when you were lost. The Great Mother came to me, and she said I'd have a boy, and his name would be Daedalus.
Daedalus, you say. Your heart is on fire. Your son. A window into your memories opens, and you see flashes of a little boy laughing, then a teenager fighting with a wooden sword, then a strong, stone-faced man in blood-soaked armor, his face burned. He stands before a city on fire, and you know this is also your home.
Daedalus, you say.
You pick up the sleeping child.
Is it really you? But how?
I don't care, you say under your breath, so Nina can't hear. I screwed up before, but I promise you, I won't make the same mistake again, Daedalus. I'll be here for you. I'll never abandon you.
What are you saying to him? Nina says.
You hand baby Daedalus back to her and smile.
It'll be okay. It's a second chance.
Yes, she says. We have two babies now. Two chances at happiness.
Years pass. You wander from land to land, year after year, trying to escape the ice. Your children grow from babies to young boys and from boys to men. Nina and you both grow old, but your love for each other never falters.
Bronn becomes a natural leader. He's a strong hunter. He's handsome and charismatic. He's a lot like his grandfather, whose name he shares. The similarities are uncanny. Daedalus, on the other hand, grows cold and hard. No matter how much care you give him, how much love and affection, he slowly pushes you away, just as he did in some other world. Or is it all just some nightmarish déjà vu playing itself over and over in your mind?
Bronn and Daedalus hate each other. They often fight over the simplest things. As the fighting intensifies, you worry they'll come to blows. There appears to be no possible resolution to their animosity for each other. The clan knows it too. They have an old story about one brother who killed another. It unbalanced the spirit world and led to the spread of the snows. To prevent another fratricide, they banished Daedalus from the clan. You know a person cannot survive in the wilderness alone. Nina knows it too. You have to make a decision. You promised yourself you would never leave Nina again. But you also promised Daedalus you'd never abandon him. With great tears and a wrenching heart, you say goodbye to Bronn and Nina and follow Daedalus into the night.
Thank you.
You and Daedalus wander the world for many seasons, always heading south. You pass great towering mountains and lush green valleys. You enter a field of wild grain that takes you a month to cross. You skirt a desert where you find large, ancient statues of men and women with animal heads, the rock cracked and hoary with age. You find yourself on a white sand beach, the green waters lapping in gentle rhythms. You throw your clothes off and swim, luxuriating in the warm, refreshing water. Daedalus looks more cautious. "It's okay, son," you say. "It's just like a big lake, but it's warm." He wades in, stony-faced as usual, not even able to enjoy the sea. "What's that?" he says, pointing behind you. You turn. "It's just an island. There's smoke coming from it, and it's moving." You turn again. "That's no island. It's a ship. A steamship." You hadn't noticed it before because you hadn't expected to see such a thing in this world. A steamship. Another memory. Another clue about your past. You and Daedalus continue down the coast. You pass through towns and small cities where you see steam cars and planes. These things are a wonder to you, but they're also oddly familiar. In one of the rare moments Daedalus speaks to you, he admits he also remembers these things, and that he has an overwhelming feeling of coming home. When a plane flies overhead, he says the word Persephone. You ask him what that name means, but he says he doesn't know. It's an orphaned memory. "Persephone," you whisper to yourself. "The name means something to you as well." People speak of a great city called Alexandria, and you and Daedalus decide to head there. There's a desert between where you are and the city that would take you many days to cross, so you decide to catch a ride on a merchant ship from one of the towns. It's a small ironclad steamship with one smokestack that puffs out dark black soot. After 3 days of putting along the coast, you see the beam of a lighthouse. Planes fly overhead, swarms of planes. As you approach the city, you seem to join a throng of other ships bargaining with each other to make entry into the embrace of the jetties and into the heart of the city with its streets clogged with people. "Have you seen this before?" you ask Daedalus. "Seems an odd question for you to ask your son. Whose every moment you've followed since he was born in the ice of the north. Yet the memories have been pouring in over the past few days for both of you. New discoveries."
"Yes," he says.
"I think I have too," you say.
"What were you here for?"
I think it was for business. I was meeting someone. I remember this place."
"What was your business?"
You rub the back of your neck. You pull your hand away and look at it. It works. Your hand works. You flex your fingers and draw your other hand up and down, your arm feeling the faint textured pattern of the carbon fiber under your skin.
"You okay?" Daedalus says.
"My arm works," you say, and hold it up to him. He nods. You rub your wrist. Your skin is old.
"I think it's this way," Daedalus says. "Yes, it's this way."
"Where are you taking us?"
"I don't know.
But it's not far, I know that. You follow your son's lead through the crowd and down a series of side streets. He's wearing armor and has a sword in its hilt. You wear a robe, a nice robe with gold embroidery. Wait, you say, the library. There it is, a gleaming marble edifice framed by dark apartment buildings that line the street. I'd been there. Later, Daedalus says, we have to see Persephone. An image of a girl flashes through your memory. She's a beautiful girl, and you know you love her just as much as you love Nina. My granddaughter, you say, and your heart pounds with excitement. I'm sorry, Daedalus, you say to your son as you wait in the atrium, the shaded waiting room in the palace. He looks up at you with cold eyes. What are you talking about? He says. I'm sorry I wasn't there for you when you were young. The first time. I mean, back in Athens. I was so focused on my business, and I didn't spend enough time with you. I've been thinking about it. I think that may be why you wouldn't let me see Persephone. I was giving her the attention I should have given. I was giving her the attention I should have given you. You were angry at me for it. Daedalus looks down. He puts his face in his hands. When you look up, his eyes are wet with tears. He sniffs them back and looks away. You were good to me this time, he says. You forgive me? Yeah. You had a second chance. This time you were good to me. You came with me. You could have stayed with Mom. My other mom. I don't understand what's going on, Daedalus. It seems like two worlds are colliding, and I'm not sure why. Is it so bad? It's not just you who gets a second chance. I get a second chance with Persephone. I was a real bastard to her, but I'm going to make it right. Now it's your turn to tear up. Second chance. A second chance to bring your family together, and to do it right this time. How often do you get a second chance? I wish your mother was here, you say. She'd be proud of you. Which one? You both chuckle. The doors open, and Persephone walks in, a proud, confident woman. Her face is grave. You can walk, Daedalus says, his jaw open. Your jaw is open, too. She's so tall. Never mind that, she says. We're in danger. Cultus is back.
Cultus?
Daedalus says. Come with me, Persephone says, and turns through the doors. Follow her down a porticoed hall that looks into a courtyard filled with tropical plants. How can you walk? Daedalus says to her again. Surgery. We'll talk about it another time. It strikes you that the Greek Renaissance in this world is more advanced than you thought. It's extended not just to steamships and flying machines, but also to medicine. What a wondrous world this is. And then the image of Cultus's face flashes through your mind. That barbarian with his horde of black-cloaked demons who destroyed Athens, killing your friends and family and burning countless works of art. Persephone says he's back. But how could he be? He was killed in the war, and Rome was destroyed. Come on, Persephone says through a set of doors at the end of the portico. You run down the hall. You're in a large room that looks out onto a balcony, and there is a stunning view of the Mediterranean with its azure blue waters. Remember this room. A number of high-ranking generals stand around a table covered in maps. Daedalus has just joined them. He doesn't look out of place with his gold-trimmed uniform that seems to have become more elegant, more modern, since you first noticed it back in the atrium. But it's Persephone who you want to look at, your beautiful granddaughter. She's standing so strong and sure, her long hair flowing over her shoulders, a few strands of gray giving her the confidence of age. She commands this room of powerful men, and when she speaks, they all cast their eyes down out of respect. "If he has taken Cyprus, he can strike anywhere along the Levant," she says, gesturing down the coast of the Mediterranean. "Can he reach Alexandria?" One of the generals speaks.
"We have reports that Cultus is building a fleet of large galleons on Cyprus. They have long flat decks and can allow planes to take off and land. Once this fleet is done, he will be able to strike the Delta and threaten our air force." "Is there any way to destroy this fleet before it's completed?" Daedalus says.
"It is possible," the general says, "but it would be a suicide mission."
"What do you mean?" Persephone says.
"Marine invasions tend to favor the defender, if the forces are equal, and our forces are not equal to his. Cultus enjoys superiority in all spheres around Cyprus, in land, sea, and air. The best we could offer is a limited strike, perhaps a night raid, but the risks to those involved would be immense."
"Then we can't do it. What else can we do?"
"There's not much, I'm afraid, except preparing the defenses."
"And what are your plans for those?"
"Well, we don't know where he will land, unfortunately. The Delta is vast, and he could land anywhere."
"Tell me more about the galleys."
A man who wears the markings of an admiral clears his throat.
"These ships the Romans are building, they're not just flat-topped, they're also flat-bottomed."
"Flat-bottomed? What's your point?"
"The point is, they are designed to navigate rivers. Cultus can bring his ships and troops and aircraft right up the river. He'll be able to move around the Delta at will. Our heavy guns face out to the sea. But with these ships he's building, Cultus can navigate around the Delta tributaries and strike us from behind."
"Flat-bottomed? Doesn't that mean they'll be less maneuverable in open water? Can't we strike him with our fast ships?"
"Out at sea, he will have air cover, and our navy will not."
"Well, what about our air force? Can't we mobilize them from land? Say, up the Levant across from Cyprus. Surely they have the range."
Another of the generals steps forward, this one with the markings of a pilot.
"We certainly have the planes, and we have the range. But what we lack is knowledge of when we will engage the enemy at sea. If we knew the exact moment when that would take place, we could launch our entire air force at once. But we will not have that knowledge, so our planes will have to run in shifts. The best we could do is have a third of our force in the air at any given time, and they would likely be exhausted from the shift work.
Why don't we find the enemy and then feign a retreat? We could draw them back closer to land so our planes could hit them with full force."
"That would only work if we match them in the skies and hold their planes at bay. Otherwise, we sacrifice the ships, which will never be able to outrun their planes."
"Gentlemen, this is sounding hopeless. Tell me you have a plan." The generals shuffle their feet and look down.
"A plan! I want a plan!"
"You're feeling tired. You're old, and it's difficult to stand for long periods of time." Daedalus notices you leaning against the table. He takes you by the arm and asks to be excused.
"This is not looking good," he says once you've left the room.
"I know, Daedalus. Do you remember Athens? Do you remember how you led the forces out?"
"Yes. Unfortunately, you raise painful memories."
"They mustn't meet Cultus in battle. The Romans are unstoppable, even against superior weapons."
I know.
"The only way to stop Cultus is to destroy those galleons. Trap them on Cyprus and starve him."
"You heard what the general said. It's a suicide mission."
"Son, I don't care about that. It's all coming back to me now. Look at me. I'm old and I'm dying. Look at my arm. It's dead again. Daedalus gives you a somber smile. I'll take the winged victory to Cyprus. I'll go at night and burn those ships. I don't care if they kill me. As long as you and Penelope are safe, that's all I care about.
That's very thoughtful of you. Let's get you back to your room for a nap, and then we can talk more about it.
The jab hurts, but there may be truth in it. You're old, you're tired, and you do need a nap.
You wake. You're in a soft bed, and the golden rays of the evening sun are pouring through the large windows of the palace. You hear seagulls outside, and the sounds of the nearby fish market. You rise and stretch your old limbs. Your back is sore, and your joints are stiff, but you don't care. You throw on your robe and leave your room. You enter the library. It's just as you remember it. The immense palatial entrance is beautifully ornate. It's the most beautiful building in the world, even more beautiful than the palace, in a way. You think it's because it's more elegant and less ostentatious. The capitals are a simple feminine Ionic, and not the more gaudy Corinthian of the palace, with their unending vines and blossoms. You like the simplicity. You like how it permeates the whole structure. The whitewashed walls, the simple egg and dart. It breathes. It's relaxing, just as a library should be. The ornaments should not distract from the books. And what books? In your lifetime, you've watched as the printing press increased the titles into the millions. But you have no time to look at books. You find your way to the offices and to the head of the aeronautics department. A woman in her 50s greets you with warm familiarity.
"So, you're back," she says.
"Yes, I made it. I don't have much time, unfortunately.
Do you still have the winged victory?"
The woman takes you to the roof of the library, where you see prototypes of many new and exotic planes.
"There are better planes now," she says,
"but the winged victory is truly one of a kind."
"Help me up onto it."
"You're going to fly it? Aren't you a little old?"
"I don't have time. The sun is already setting. Please help me up."
She looks like she's about to fight you on that point, but she gives in. You pull the straps over your shoulders and put on your goggles and skullcap.
"Please, if you wouldn't mind, the propeller.
Does your granddaughter know you're doing this?"
Then you realize you never said goodbye to her. She would never let you do this, of course. Not if she'd known. But you should have said goodbye. A sadness washes over you at the thought of her discovering you left on this crazy mission without even a goodbye. You just smile and then take one last look at Alexandria. Beautiful, vibrant Alexandria. The adopted home of your family. The place where all your hopes live. You will protect this place, this beautiful place, and you will protect your family. The catapult launches you into the sky.
That was Blue Dragons Part 6 by myself, Jordan Harbour. We've now launched Part 2 of Labyrinth of Doom, and it's ready for you to have a listen in Patreon. Labyrinth of Doom is a storytelling game I'm playing with our patrons. I tell you part of the story, you are left with a challenge at the end of the show, and then you get to decide what you'll do next. We have a poll up on Patreon, and you are asked to make your choice. Will you try to get the magic bow, or will you return the way you came? head on over to Patreon now. Listen to The Labyrinth of Doom, Part 1 and 2, and then complete the poll. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening to The Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care.